Good morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Free Market Underground, where every week we bring you all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager for Butler Lands and Wagler. And Free Market Underground is produced every week by Mr. Martell Love, and the show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. Good morning, Martell Love.
Good morning, Mr. Chris Butler. How are you today?
I am good. How are you?
I'm very good on this Saturday morning.
Yeah, good weather expected this weekend. Give us a little hint of spring. And as we get into March, I guess we should expect more and more of that.
Are you ready for spring?
I am ready.
I am so ready.
But I can also remember in my lifetime several Easter Sundays where we have had snow.
Yes.
Yeah. I say several, maybe two. So I know that it can, and sometimes Easter is in March, late March, but more often than not, it's in April. Early April, right?
This year it's on April Fool's Day.
Is it? April 1st.
Yep.
April 1st. So I'm not going to be really excited for spring until we get post-Easter.
Question for you. Do you know what determines what day Easter is on?
No. Okay. I don't. I know that it's 40 days after, for Catholics anyway, it's 40 days in Lent, right?
Right.
So, but
right.
When is, your so question really when is, when does Lent begin?
Yes, yeah.
And I don't know. I do not know.
I have to look that up.
Yeah, right. And
because you know, Easter can fall anywhere between. It could be in March. It could be in April.
Right.
But why and where does it fall?
I have no clue. Yeah. I really don't. I probably should know that. But that is a job for Martell Love.
That's
and your
right.
favorite website, Wikipedia.
Yes.
Wikipedia providing value all the time.
Yes. In every way that we need it.
That's right. It is very convenient. The only problem I've got with Wikipedia generally is that you never know who wrote the page.
That's right.
And what kind of biases they might be bringing to the table. And I don't care if they write a biased page, but I would like to know who to attribute that to.
Right.
And if it is possibly biased based on if I know who that person is.
You know what I heard from Dan Israel, who is the executive producer of Chiefs Radio Network. If you want to know the first place, if you want to find out something that went on in the NFL – if a free agent signed somewhere or someone retired, check Wikipedia.
Is that right?
Wikipedia will tell it first before anybody else. Wikipedia. I know.
Providing value.
Providing value. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
I did not know
that.
Marcus
Peters trade, Wikipedia.
Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. Had it first.
That's interesting. If you had asked me which news service generally covers breaking NFL news first, I would have guessed Twitter.
Right.
And maybe Twitter does actually have rumors first, but maybe Wikipedia actually has the news.
I guess that's what it is.
But if Dan Israel uses it,
exactly,
that's good enough for me.
I would never thought to go to Wikipedia first to check my NFL news.
No.
But apparently, they're on their stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good for Wikipedia, another use for it. I didn't think that could possibly be increased in my life.
Prince dies, Wikipedia.
Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wikipedia's on it.
Yep.
I just don't know who does it. It's kind of one of those, what do they call those, open source types of things that everybody can access and contribute to and edit and whatever. So maybe that's why they're one of the first to get it, because everybody can contribute. All right, let's talk about tariffs, which seems to be the buzzword of...
It's the word of the week, right?
The week, I guess it is. Tariffs. Word of the week. Yeah.
Please define.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe before talking about it, we ought to just talk about what it is. And a tariff is a tax that you put on imported goods. And you do it so that by the time a consumer, take just a simple example of a piece of steel. Let's say a 1 pound piece of steel would cost $10. But here in the United States, our steel producers can only do a pound for 15 and still be profitable. But say China starts dumping their steel on our market for 10 bucks a pound, consumers are going to buy from the Chinese producers. That's when the U.S. government might step in and put a tariff on imported steel to make Chinese steel $15 a pound. In other words, a 50% tariff on the price of Chinese steel. So now you've got $15 steel coming from China, even though they're selling it to the United States at 10. But before the consumer can get it, there's already a tariff been placed on it. and that is $5. So you got $15 versus U.S. made steel at $15. Now it's a toss up. What do you buy, U.S. or Chinese? Doesn't matter. Same price, assuming same quality, by the way. So that's what a tariff is. It's just a tax on imported goods. And the way to look at it economically is that basically the reason that we might impose a tariff on that Chinese steel is because it's hurting U.S. steel manufacturers. So the consumer will pay more for his steel after the tariff in order to protect the workers in the steel industry. Generally speaking, there are more people that use steel, buy steel, than there are people in the country that work for a steel company that produce it. More consumers of steel than producers of steel. So we're asking a lot of people to bear a little bit of pain so that a group of people bear none. And that's what a tariff is. That's the economic impact. Now, if you can forget about national security concerns, which plays a role in this debate, by the way, but ignoring that for a second, there is no economic rationale for borders. When you're doing economics, pure economics, there is no such thing as a national border. I mean, imagine the absurdity of each 50 states in the United States, if we were to, instead of calling them states, we called them countries. And as it turns out, most of the great paying tech jobs are in San Francisco, California. And most of the acting jobs and movie jobs and television jobs are in Los Angeles, California. Boy, would you hear from New York, unfair trade practices. That's how absurd it is. Just because California is part of the United States, apparently, New York doesn't care that California has all of those things. But when you put national security into the mix, then it does matter. Then borders matter. Then you have to start worrying about the fact that, okay, if we just let the most efficient producers of steel produce the steel and sell it to us, we don't need a steel industry. The problem is, if ever you were to go to war and you don't have a steel industry, you got some problems. So I have no answers. I know that economically speaking, tariffs are bad. I also know this. George W. Bush implemented a similar steel tariff in 2002, and it did not even last 2 years. And the reason why is because the EU, the European Union, started to threaten the United States with pulling all of its agricultural orders from the U.S. And buying from somewhere else. And so we backed off of that tariff. So that is what's called a trade war, tit for tat. You do this, we'll do that. Pretty soon, what happens is, if, especially since the United States has always had and still has a very large exporting economy, what happens is those folks that are in those industries making goods for export to foreign countries, they start to get hurt by those foreign countries slapping tariffs on our goods. And so you get the profitability in aggregate of U.S. firms falling because we're selling less. We were selling a lot of wheat to Europe. After that proposed tariff, threatened tariff, we would be selling none to Europe. What do you think that would do to our farming sector? It would hurt. Now, I don't know how much it would have hurt in 2002, but it would hurt a little bit to a moderate amount now. The problem is, when everybody retaliates, what if all of the people that sell us steel currently retaliate and say no more U.S. goods can be shipped into our countries without paying a tariff? And that is what a trade war looks like. By the way, for a brief history lesson, if we can think back to high school when we were learning about the Great Depression, does the phrase Smoot-Hawley tariff ring any bells? I have seen a fascinating study of the stock market crash of 1929 and the Smoot-Hawley tariff debates at that same time. The stock market started to lose its legs in 1929 when Smoot-Hawley started to gain steam. And with every headline that said Smoot-Hawley was making headway, and this was a huge, huge multinational tariff plan to protect our jobs here. The more steam it got, the more support it got, the more the market started to break down. I don't know that I wouldn't go so far, in fact, to say that it was the cause of the stock market crash of 1929, but it was like a game of Jenga, and Smoot-Hawley was the removal of 10 of the little wooden blocks, leading it unstable for the next big wind or shaky hand to knock it over. So it shouldn't surprise anyone that the stock market does not like this. And by the way, did the stock market not like it in 2002? No, it didn't. But it was not the same environment. It didn't like it to the degree that the market is not liking it now. It was, you didn't have any fear that this tariff would go beyond a steel tariff, and you certainly didn't get any kind of nationalistic or protectionist views coming out of the White House under the Bush era. Now the environment has changed. And I think there are valid reasons that foreigners might suspect the U.S. is shifting into a more protectionist, nationalist viewpoint, and that if they're going to retaliate at all, now would probably be in their best interest to retaliate. We need to take a break right now. When we get back, we can continue talking about that tariff with some closing remarks. We'll also talk about the economy. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710, now heard on 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we talk about all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. Just talked about the proposed tariffs. Let's keep in mind they're not a done deal yet, and they probably will be next week unless someone can talk the president out of it. But I did have some concluding remarks and thoughts on those tariffs. Yes, most economists are going to come down negatively on these tariffs because it causes the consumer more pain than the gain we're making from protecting jobs. Okay. As a consumer, most people buying steel probably don't even know where it's coming from. So they're just going to buy the cheapest steel, particularly if that consumer is a corporation, a public corporation. They owe it to their shareholders to buy their materials at the lowest cost. They can have the highest profit. That's a point that I think kind of gets ignored in all of this, is that, you know, the consumer really doesn't care. If polled, and I actually saw a poll, most people said they would be willing to pay a little bit more, maybe not most, but very close to half. People said they would be willing to pay a little bit more in steel expense to keep the American steel industry healthy. Now, that's a wonderful sentiment, but I don't know how it would work in the real world. I think a lot of times people think it's a good idea, and then when actually asked to pay 15 cents more per can of soda, they get weak-kneed and buy the cheaper stuff. So I don't know that I believe the poll, but you know, we did talk a little bit in the last segment about the national security issue behind all of this. I don't know how big that issue is, but it is an issue that needs to be addressed. I also think that if we are doing this to punish any one country, I would suggest to you that it's probably punishing a whole lot more people more than the intended target of our retribution. A lot of times there's some China bashing that goes on here, deservedly so. They are not fair in their trade. Again, I don't know that consumers care. They just like the low prices. But they are not a fair trading partner. There's no question about it. They are, and by the way, there is a technical definition for steel dumping. What does that mean? Well, I can tell you this. We have to keep this in mind when we trade with communist nations. Communist nations have absolutely no problem and no constraint on subsidizing whatever industry they want to. And they have chosen to subsidize the steel industry. But there is supposed to be a mechanism for working out these complaints. I thought that's what the World Trade Organization was supposed to do. But, and I'm not a big fan of the World Trade Organization, don't get me wrong, but the World Trade Organization even has some exceptions. They do allow a unilateral response or reaction to dumping, just like what we're doing, tariffs. They allow that. They think it's okay in cases where you can prove someone is dumping. And it's fairly easy to prove in the case of China. But the problem is that China is not even in the top 10 countries from which we import our steel. Number one is Canada at 16%. At 13%, you got Brazil, you got South Korea, Mexico, Russia, Turkey, Japan, Taiwan, Germany, and India. Now, China is one of the major exporters to the U.S. of aluminum, and that's part of the tariff too. We're proposing a 10% tariff on aluminum, 25% on steel. Wanted to talk briefly, if I can, about where we are in the economic cycle, that boom and bust phase. There's a difference between a growth rate cycle and a true cycle. In other words, in every period of boom, you're actually going to have a couple, if not more, little growth rate recessions in there where the growth rate of the U.S. economy actually decelerates. In other words, it was growing at about 4% annually and then 3% annually and then 2% annually. Was the U.S. economy growing in a positive direction? Yeah, but it was decelerating. That growth rate was becoming less and less. Now, if the U.S. economy grows at minus 1%, are we in a true recession? Yes, we are. That's more than a growth rate recession. That's a true recession. And I think if you look at the data right now, it would be very easy to conclude that we're probably embarking on a growth rate recession right now, which simply means the economic growth we've seen is decelerating. And when you get a true recession, it usually comes on the back of a growth rate recession, but certainly you get way more growth rate recessions than you do actual true recessions where the economy grows at a negative rate. So we're seeing deceleration. We're seeing it in the growth rate of the weekly leading indicators, something that I post every now and again on the show's website at freemarketunderground.com. You should go check that out because I think you can start to make the argument that we're probably looking at, I mean, it's too early to tell really, but if I had to guess, I'd say we might be embarking on a little bit of a slowdown, which was a growth rate recession. Now, I want to take the last few minutes I've got here in this segment to tell you something that I'm going to be doing here over the next several months. And that is, I'm teaching a class called Rejuvenate Your Retirement. It's at the Kansas State Extension in Olathe. And it's two nights and or 2 days, like two Thursdays or two Tuesdays, however folks want to sign up. But these are the six topics I'm going to be going over the course of two classes. Number one, how long will my money last? Retirement tax strategies. Social Security and Medicare, elder fraud prevention, long-term care and estate planning, and optimizing portfolio withdrawals. Those I've got at freemarketunderground.com. I have a link if you're interested to sign up. Now, you do have to pay for the workbook, which is $39. But there's a place there to sign up. There's also a place to order a workbook. I've got it at freemarketunderground.com. It'll be one of the links that are part of this show. The show's date, March 3rd, 2018. Look for that. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I look forward to meeting a lot of good people. It is obviously geared towards retirees, but if that's not you, but you're thinking about retiring, it might be something you're interested in. Again, the website is freemarketunderground.com. All right. We talked about tariffs. We've talked about the fact that we could quite possibly be in the throes of a growth rate recession, or maybe the very beginning of it. I'm not that concerned right now, as long as the index of leading indicators is actually still going up. It has come down with the stock market because stocks are a leading indicator, but I'm not that concerned about a full-blown recession yet. We do need to watch it. I would also make mention of the fact that we got some pretty strong data still coming out of our economy, and I want to get to those in the next segment, but we should probably also make mention of the fact that we've also had, you know, employment has looked fantastic, really, but other sectors of the economy have been disappointing or slowing down a little bit. Other sectors have been strong and getting stronger, which makes it always very difficult to tell exactly where you're at in an economic cycle. We'll talk about some of those when we get back. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back. Free Market Underground, where every week we engage you in thoughtful discourse about our economy and our markets. My name is Chris Butler, Portfolio Manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. I'm going to talk now a little bit about the economy and one of my favorite topics, money. Money supply, to be more exact and precise. Get to that in a second. But I did also want to go back and talk a little bit about the class I'm teaching at the Kansas State Extension. Wanted to make mention of the fact that that actually starts March 8th, if you were interested in doing Thursdays. Tuesdays will be the following Tuesdays when it starts. We'll talk about how long your money's going to last, retirement tax strategies, Social Security and Medicare, optimizing portfolio withdrawals, elder fraud prevention, long-term care, and estate planning. And yes, it's called Rejuvenate Your Retirement, so it presupposes you are retired, but that's not necessarily the only types of people that will benefit. If you're thinking about retiring fairly soon, it will probably also be something you can benefit from. Again, I've got that link to sign up at freemarketunderground.com. Okay, let's talk about some ways the economy actually looks pretty good. Now, I did mention that some of the sectors of the economy, maybe about 3, 4, 5 months ago, we were kind of hitting on all cylinders. Just about everything was doing better. One of the things that is starting to disturb me a little bit is the weakness in the orders for capital goods. And that absolutely started to skyrocket actually a couple of months before the election, but by the middle part of 2017 was just screaming. The last few reports on that haven't been particularly good, and that's a leading indicator, and I think it's an important one because it's looking at capital goods, goods that make other goods. You know, we for a long, long time, that number was absolutely pasty white, anemic. It was not very enthusiastic. You couldn't be very optimistic about our economy at all, and lo and behold, we had one of the worst, no, we had the worst post-World War II recovery ever, and no one was investing in property, plant, equipment, or people really for that matter. And then all of a sudden, a couple of months before the election in 2016, maybe July, August, somewhere around there, for whatever reason, people started to invest and they continued that momentum well into 2017. And it's no wonder that our economy started to pick up. You need to invest in stuff that makes stuff if you're going to increase the amount of stuff that gets sold, period. So that weakening has not been very optimistic. Now, it's still decent. It's not causing me to stay awake at night, but I'm watching it. But when we got this week the ISM manufacturing report for February, we learned that the manufacturing sector of our economy was, number one, beating even the highest expectations for that number. Number two, it's the strongest reading in 14 years. You have to go back to the year 2004 to see a manufacturing sector as giddy as the one we've got in February. And by the way, I oftentimes need to look at a similar manufacturing survey that comes out 15 minutes before the more closely watched ISM manufacturing survey, and that comes from a company called Markets. Especially when you see something as optimistic as this, do you want to look at the Markets somewhat equivalent measure? And you know what? Theirs wasn't nearly as exuberant as ISM, but it was good. And in fact, it was one of the highest numbers in the last 3 years, giving some credibility to what we saw in the ISM number. So, okay, manufacturing is one part of the economy that's actually doing pretty good. We also got a report on, and these things get released at the same time, personal income. And that measures income from whatever source derived, whether it was a salary, a wage, rent if you're a landlord, dividends if you're a stockholder, interest if you're a bondholder, whatever it is, welfare payments, it gets included in this, okay? So personal income and personal consumption expenditures, that personal income number, two great monthly increases now of 0.4%. So it's fantastic. I'll be honest, I haven't looked at it close enough to know exactly what the source of that income is. A lot of times, if it's government transfer payments, it's less exciting than if it was coming from the private sector, because that's actually paying for itself and sustainable. Personal consumption expenditures is what we're spending on stuff to consume. And that's been up 0.2% for 2 months in a row. Less impressive, because you like to see that at about 3% when you've got low levels of inflation. You like to see it even higher than that when inflation is picking up. And I tend to think that inflation is actually a lot higher than what we're being told in terms of the CPI or the PPI, Consumer Price Index, Producer Price Index. So the amount that we're spending is not as impressive as the amount of money we're making. And one of the reasons for that, and I was talking with Pete Mundo on the KCMO Morning Show on Friday about this, part of it could very well be the case that the American consumer has kind of gone back full tilt boogie on putting stuff on their credit cards, which was not as alarming when interest rates were low. It's a little bit more alarming when the cost of debt, revolving credit card debt, has gone back to where it was in 2007. So people that have spent on their credit cards are likely feeling a little bit of a pinch right now. And that's just another thing about our economy that concerns us at this juncture. Is it overwhelmingly concerning? No, but I certainly don't think it's a good thing. I would prefer to see, for a long, long time after the financial crisis, people were not using their credit cards. And I thought that was fantastic. But I think what was going on is people were still paying off their credit cards or scared to use them as their hands got burnt in the financial crisis, which was 2007 to 2009. That is kind of a development that would concern me. And it's not just the household sector. It's corporations. It's the government. Notice that as the economy heats up a little bit, we've got all three sectors reaching levels of indebtedness that they had before the financial crisis. And there's more people, so maybe it's not that alarming yet. But on the other hand, I'm not really sure that the government has that excuse. There was one federal government in 2007. There's one federal government today, and they have run up the bill. I was asked to respond to a former mayor of a large metropolitan area in an interview earlier in the week that had said that he didn't like, and he's a Democrat, didn't like Donald Trump taking credit for the economy that Barack Obama handed him. And he actually said it was the greatest economy of modern times, what Obama gave to Donald Trump. I don't think that I would go around singing that tune if you consider the fact that, and by the way, a lot of stuff did actually start to turn around late in Obama's presidency. That is true. But the fact remains that you had one of the weakest recoveries on record, the weakest recovery since World War II, and at what cost? Well, we went from about $9 trillion of debt to 20, or just under 20, in that time. So in other words, if you look at debt as trying to buy your way out of a recession, we got very little bang for every buck of debt that we accumulated. And I would proffer this, and this goes back to what I was talking about with Pete Mundo on Friday. I would proffer this argument that because we took on so much debt in that recovery, that's why it was so anemic. It is hard to get your economy to grow at a reasonably high rate when it is being weighed down with so much debt. And it wasn't just debt from the federal government at first or at the end. It was all of this accumulated debt acts as a lodestone. It hampers the consumer's ability. If we're talking about consumer debt, it hampers their ability to consume. It also, if you've got a lot of credit card debt, it hampers your ability to buy a house. Because of all the money printing we did, houses weren't that affordable starting in 2010, 2011. I think both Trump and Obama are going to have a problem with all the money printing, the damage from the money printing that the Fed did. But I think it's ultimately going to be something that cracks under Donald Trump's presidency, because when he took office, stocks were already at very high valuation levels. And the Federal Reserve, which had been very accommodative, and they weren't doing that because they were in favor of President Obama. They were doing it because that's their mandate. That's what they do. And it just so happens that as they started to take away the punch bowl, Donald Trump walked into office. So it will be something to watch in terms of what the reaction will be from a slowing economy, which I hope never happens, beyond these little growth recessions that happen that we've been talking about. Hope it doesn't happen. But if it does, it'll be interesting to see what the response is, because when you are already over indebted and you've already cut interest rates so low, you just don't have a whole lot you can do. That was the warning that I hope somebody gave the Fed and the government back in 2008, 9, and 10. Something tells me if that was the message, it wasn't getting listened to. All right, we need to take a break. We get back, we'll talk about the stock market. You're listening to Free Market Underground on KCMO Talk Radio 710, now heard on 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust. where every week we try to make a little bit of sense out of our world. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler, and Martel Love is the master of funk. Last two bumps, funky. Appreciate it.
No problem. I bring the funk.
You do bring the funk.
Yes.
Martel, and I saw Martel's new, and he's a DJ, saw his laptop last week. New laptop?
Yes, new laptop.
We should probably start billing you as the man that has funk in his trunk, because you have a lot of funk in that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. I like it.
That's free, Martel.
Thank
that
you.
Comes
I appreciate
free.
That. Don't worry. I'll give you credit.
The man with funk in the trunk.
Come put that on my business
That's
card.
That's right.
That's right.
Martel Love. All right. Let's talk about money for a second. We'll shift into the stock market, but the two are connected. I actually posted this on the Facebook page. And if you haven't checked out Free Market Underground on Facebook, do so. If you like us, greatly appreciated. If you follow us, you'll probably see a couple of posts every day that relate in some way, shape, or form to markets, free markets, et cetera. And it's really just culling maybe the day's best two articles that I've read that have some kind of relevance to free markets and the benefit of that. Again, just check out Free Market Underground on Facebook. Posted this article earlier in the week, which showed that as the stock market, once it kind of went down 10%, 12%, and then bounced, that bounce coincided with, well, what recently published data shows anyway, that the Fed's balance sheet, something they have supposed to have been trimming down now, actually grew by a rather large amount the week that the stock market bounced back. Some websites were calling it QE4. But you need to keep in mind, too, that if you actually inject $14 billion into the banking system, that can be leveraged by 10 times, and you get $141 billion. Okay, so it's not that insignificant. It is, I wouldn't call it terribly significant, but it's not insignificant either. So it looks like this sounds a little conspiratorial, I guess, but it looks like the Fed is watching volatility in the stock market, and quite honestly, I wish they wouldn't. Another article that I posted on Facebook, Free Market Underground, relates to the money supply of the United States. And the money supply of the United States is falling. Actually, the previous six times that U.S. money supply growth has been this low, we've seen a recession ensue in four of those instances. So, and two of them, no recession. Four of them, yes, recession. Okay, so it's something to keep an eye on, especially if you're an investor. We've talked ad nauseum about how you cannot get a rising stock market consistently if you're not putting more and more money into the system. We're not. We're actually backing off. We're taking it away. That's what we mean by taking away the punch bowl. So the European Central Bank and the Japanese Central Bank have been kind of taking charge of the global money supply, and those dollars have found a home here in the United States, our markets. But here's something else that's bothering markets, and this just came out overnight before Friday's open of the stock market. Japanese Bank of Japan Governor Kuroda unexpectedly announced that the Bank of Japan is going to start thinking about how to exit its massive, over-the-top quantitative easing program around the fiscal year starting in April 2019, so that's about a year from now, and that there could be policy changes before their 2% inflation target is achieved, making that the first time Kuroda has ever provided any kind of guidance on the timing of their really weird Uber QE policy, which, by the way, for those not in the know, is simply just printing up money out of thin air. And that money has been coming to the United States to buy stocks. So oops, somebody has got to keep printing their money if global stocks are going to keep going up, and that might actually be Europe. Because there were rumors this week that Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, might be looking to put off their own plans for normalization, which they had been talking about for a long, long time. So if that's true, would that even be enough money printing to keep the global rally going? We don't know. But my fear has been, and I've started talking about this in October, that you're getting a lot of central banks that are pulling back on the punch bowl. They're not being accommodative. They no longer are supporting stocks, or that's harsh. They're supporting stocks less and less. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind if you're an investor. Now, I did want to take a little bit of time to kind of recap where we're at on stocks. The S&P 500, which is a stock market index, lost almost 12% from its intraday high on January 26th to its intraday low, which was February 9th. And it recovered almost 75% of what was lost by the high on February 27th, which was Tuesday. But Tuesday also saw a big reversal in the market and ended up down. So it's now only recovered about one-third of what it had lost, thanks to the last 4 days of the week. Now, is this retesting the lows? I don't know, but I did know that markets rarely go in a V. They rarely take several days to go down and then several days to go right back where they were. So at the very least, what you're seeing is the market work out some of its anxieties. The volatility curve, which is my best indicator of market fear, is going back up again. 50% of the S&P 500, in other words, 250 companies have stocks that are actually down more than 10%. And that calculation was made, by the way, in the middle of the week. Okay, so maybe it's more. I don't know. Only 60% of the S&P 500 are in long-term uptrends. 40% are in downtrends. And the last reading, this is perhaps the most interesting, the last reading from the American Association of Individual Investors shows we still have a moderately bullish sentiment at the retail level, which means we could still have room on the downside. So there has been no sign of capitulation of buyers. And as we said last week, there's been no resounding breadth thrust on the upside indicating uber bullishness either. So we can't say the market is decidedly bullish or decidedly bearish. And by the way, if you look at breadth since the bottom on February 9th, people have been buying only a handful of stocks. The buying is not widespread. It's in fact a scarily narrow list of winners. But there has been good buying volume, meaning not spectacular, by the way, but good. It means that they have been spending a lot of money on stocks, yes, but very few of them, not the market as a whole. People are becoming stock pickers at this junction, which I think is very interesting. That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for this week. I want to ask you to stay tuned for Don Wales, Protecting Your Retirement. That comes up next. This show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. Thanks for listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust. Until next Saturday, have a great week. And by the way, thank you, Martell Love.